Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jo Kwong. I'm the Director of Philanthropic Services for the Roundtable, and it's my great pleasure to be moderating this panel on entrepreneurship. It's a great topic, and if I can make a couple introductory remarks to just set the stage here a little bit. Job creation is something that everybody is talking about right now. You can barely open a newspaper without some charge being leveled against the administration for not creating enough jobs. And similarly, the administration responds to these charges by always documenting how many jobs they have created through public investment and public spending. But I'd like to offer this question: are we really focusing on the right thing when we focus on job creation? And I'm reminded of an economics professor of mine who would say, we can create jobs by hiring someone to fill holes and then paying someone to come along behind them and fill the hole. You know, dig hole, fill hole, create a lot of jobs. And just because we're doing an activity and somebody's getting a paycheck, have we actually created any wealth or added value to society? And I think those are the more interesting questions. And so the nice thing about this panel is we're not looking at job creation in the public sector, but instead we're looking at the flip side. How can private sector add to economic growth and wealth creation? And that indeed is the focus of the institutions that are represented here by our panelists. These organizations look at entrepreneurship, which is vitally important right now when we realize that new jobs are overwhelmingly being created by young and new firms, by entrepreneurial activity. I'm personally a big fan of Austrian economics, which defines entrepreneurs as people who are looking at situations and finding holes, finding the unmet needs. What goods and services can I provide that people will pay for? And acting on those impulses or those observations. And if these entrepreneurs are right, and they bring a good or service to market, then people will buy those. And in that process of creating the product or service and having others take their hard-earned dollars and exchanging and buying them, there's an exchange. Both people are coming to the table and voluntarily exchanging, and they're walking away both happy. Wealth is created. Well, if all of that is true and job creation through entrepreneurship is such an important thing, what do we know about entrepreneurship? And those are some of the things that we are going to be looking at in this session. Can entrepreneurship be taught? What are some of the factors behind successful entrepreneurs and new startups? And what are some of the factors behind their failures? Are there examples that can be replicated and are scalable? How can we find ways to expand the wealth-creating opportunities that come through entrepreneurship? Now, I've used the word wealth a lot, and I think one of the nice things that you will see through our panelists, the word wealth doesn't just mean dollars. And in fact, the thing that I found very interesting as I was talking to our panelists ahead of time and preparing this is the wealth that they're talking about is very inspiring. It's looking at the individuals as generators of wealth, and individuals who can find not only meaningful and inspiring things to do with their creative genius, their talents, but at the same time create jobs and add wealth in this broad sense of the word wealth. I won't take any more time to talk about that because it's a topic I'm very interested in and I'm just amazed at it. So I really want to just introduce our speakers so that they can take the floor and that we can have a wonderful conversation. My first panelist that's going to be speaking is Dane Spangler, who comes to us from the Kauffman Foundation, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, foundation that's devoted to the study and practice of entrepreneurship. And its founder, Ewing Marion Kauffman, was very much in this vein that I was just speaking about, because he embraced enterprise building as one of the most effective ways to realize individual promise and spur the economy. And in pursuit of their donor's intent, the Kauffman Foundation has launched and been expanding a huge range of entrepreneurship programs and studies many of which Dane will be talking to us about today, including the Kaufman Labs for Enterprise Creation and a host of collaborative programs, some of which collaborative partners may be here in this room right now. I'm not sure. So I'm very pleased to have Dane with us, but I'm also going to go right ahead and introduce Jeff Sandifer so that he can launch right into his presentation. And Jeff is interesting for this panel in particular because, like Dane, he brings two different aspects that are essential. He's an entrepreneur himself, having started many different businesses and successful companies, first at the age 16. Most recently, he sold Sandifer Capital, an oil and gas investment firm with several billion dollars in assets. But in addition to his entrepreneurial expertise, Jeff's passion is teaching. And indeed, he has won many teaching awards, including Business Week's one of the top entrepreneurship professors in the United States. One of the things that he will be talking to us about is the Acton School of Business, which he created with a number of his colleagues, which really gives traditional MBA programs a run for its money. And you'll be hearing about it, but what I really want to read to you is that just last week, the Princeton Review ranked the Atlas Experience as the third best MBA program in the nation, above Harvard, Stanford, and Wharton, making it, thank you, John, 8 years in a row that the Princeton Review has honored the school. And lastly, let me just say that just recently, him and his wife, Laura, have started a program for elementary schools, the Acton Academy, and in the first 10 months, its students have gained 2.5 grade levels in math and reading. And this is the part I want to hear him talk about, without a single lecture by a teacher. So between Dane and Jeff, we have a lot of interesting and new approaches to entrepreneurship that I think you'll all find very stimulating, and I'm going to turn it over to them in just a moment, but first I want to tell you the format that I'll be taking so I don't look like the heavy. Each one is going to speak for 15 minutes, and we've agreed that I'm going to be a bully about that time, so if I look rude up here and taking that hook and cutting that, it's because they've asked me to do that so that we can turn the floor back to you for as long, for as much Q&A as possible. So 15 minutes to Dane, 15 minutes to Jeff, and then time for you, and then 2 minutes for each of them to add some closing remarks, and we'll be on our way. So with that...
Madam Chairperson, we're going to swap.
Oh, you decided...
Well, I'm going to take the big picture, and Dane's going to go with the specific call.
Okay, I'll tell you, right. As entrepreneurs, these guys are always thinking on their feet, because everything we agree, they have turned around. So I guess it's a mark of entrepreneurship. You know, you take the opportunities as they come. Jeff,
all right,
you're first.
Well, it's a joy and honor to be here. I want to make it clear, while I love entrepreneurship and I'm an entrepreneur, I'm really here today as a teacher. And to try to share with you a view from the classroom looking up at the paradigm of education, how we think about educating entrepreneurs. Don't worry, I hate PowerPoints, so these are pictures, not words that you have to read. But this is the title of the whole talk. I think entrepreneurial education is the future of education. So this is not just teaching entrepreneurs, this is changing the whole form of education as we teach entrepreneurs, and it's coming faster than you think. So what's the view of traditional education? And I'm controversial here. I think traditional education is just like General Motors. It's bureaucratic, it's a hierarchy. It turns out, at best, it provides very mediocre products that are overpriced and does so because mainly of a tenured workforce, whether it's the K-12 teachers unions or the tenured professors in higher education. And the last thing that makes it like, if they didn't have government support and government protection, they'd be out of business. So these are the heavies for today. Entrepreneurial education, the new wave that I think is coming, is going to look like this. Google plus Alcoholics Anonymous plus Boy Scouts. Now, if that doesn't pique your curiosity, nothing will. We'll come back to this, but remember, Google, Alcoholics Anonymous, Boy Scouts. The goal of education, I think, is changing, too. Learning to know has been, at least since the turn of the 20th century, what education's been about. the more I can memorize of what somebody smart like Larry Gill has said and repeat it back, the more I get a dog biscuit and get tapped on the head and get an A. The intellectual or pseudo-intellectual elite is convinced us that they really actually know how to run the world. We should listen to them, teachers, so this is a teacher-centered world. I think that's going away. I think what we're going to find, and what we're finding, particularly at Acton MBA program and the Acton Academy, is what you really do is you get kids and students doing something. You give them a big, important challenge. When they can't do it, suddenly they become interested in learning to know. Theory becomes interesting if I need theory to inform action. And finally, through that struggle, through that hero's journey, you learn to be, you learn to become, you learn character. You don't learn character by being lectured about character. You learn character by facing challenges, getting knocked down, and getting back up. So, and we're also moving from this teacher-driven model. I talk, you listen, you repeat, to what I'm going to claim is a student-inspired model. Completely different model. This is a different paradigm that fits exactly how to educate entrepreneurs, who I really think represent a large portion of the American population. We had 14 million businesses started in this country last year. Enormous number there. So this is not a small piece of America. We're also moving from diplomas as empty credentials. Now, in higher ed, has it finally struck people that $300,000 for a piece of paper that means nothing except that you were smart enough to get into Harvard or Stanford or some second-tier school is really not worth much? So I think we're moving from diplomas as empty credentials. We'll talk about this. This is where the Boy Scouts come in. To vibrant portfolios. At the Acton Academy at the elementary school, we no longer allow teachers to tell a parent how a child's doing. We have very in-depth portfolios of the student's work, standards at which what a third or fourth or fifth grader should be doing to compare to, and the parents can decide how the students are doing as opposed to grade level. So I don't know if I'm listening to a teacher's opinion, I see the actual work of the students. And at the Acton MBA level, we're moving to a portfolio of work and tests that shows what you can actually do as measured and verified by a guide or a mentor who actually knows what you're doing. So we're moving to a totally different idea of how you think about and measure success. Okay, so first though, I want to take you on a very quick step through educational history and how we got to this strange paradigm that learning to know and experts lecturing and us repeating somehow made some sense. So a quick stroll through education history. Here's the old school model in the United States before modern education. One room schoolhouse, kids of all ages, one room together. That's what we do at Acton Academy, and anyone that tells you it doesn't work is crazy. It's fabulous how well it works. The McGuffey reader, family, and church. To get this moral foundation so you can go out and struggle in the world. And then a master apprenticeship model for teaching how to do something. Now this old school model, this antiquated model, only produced George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Thomas Edison. And all the innovation we had up until the early 20th century, the early 1900s. Then came modern education. Now guess where modern education came from? Well-meaning philanthropists like us, the Carnegie Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, primarily Carnegie, who said we must actually, as we bring people in from the rural areas to work in the factories, we need a docile workforce. We're very worried about social unrest, so we need to train people to listen, follow orders, and execute in a factory without getting out of hand. Once I read all this history and understood it, the idea of public schools with rows of industrial lockers and bells that rang every 45 minutes and sitting in neat, orderly rows with people of your own age and of usually of your own kind and having someone talk at you and give you orders and have them repeat it back made a lot more sense. I understood where it came from. Students were seen as widgets. How many times have you heard that the role of the school system is to create productive citizens for society? That's what we want to do in education, right? Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Students are individual human beings. each on their own hero's journey. It is a moral outrage to me. He said that we were going to create productive citizens for society. I had a good friend that told me there's only one way you can measure a masterpiece. Very simple. That teacher has to believe that each and every student that walks in the door is a genius. And your job is to figure out what their genius had and inspire them to pursue. So I think this idea of students as widgets, however we got down that paradigm, it was a terrible path to take. Higher education's lost its way too. Give you a quick primer on how that happened. Up until the turn of the 20th century, very few people went to college. A couple of percent of the population. It was mainly for lawyers and preachers. Early colleges, that's what they did. With a very religious background, usually. And it was really only until the GI Bill came along that we really expanded college. A good thing, probably. Something else happened in World War II. Also, the Manhattan Project built the bomb. Lots of government money into scientific research. Maybe good, maybe bad, we'll see in a minute. Now, the academics who weren't getting the high-paid jobs with the black coats in the laboratories, they were a little jealous. So along comes LBJ and the Great Society, and we start paying social scientists, whatever that means, to do social research. So what we have today is a system of higher education that really doesn't care much about students. What it cares about is lots of federal dollars. They get paid to academics to do academic research. By the way, two-thirds of the money we spend in this country, $200 billion a year, goes to pay for narrow academic research articles costing $50,000 each that on average a dozen people will read. So somewhere along in this, higher education lost its way too. Now, good news. That's the end of the bad news. Good news. There are breakthroughs and coming breakthroughs coming. For K-12, I really think the bubbling up and the disruptive innovation is going to come out of the homeschools. We're now up to more than 1.5 million students in homeschools. The numbers are growing greatly. And no longer are homeschool students seen as these weird religious nuts that are kept in the closet by their parents. You go to Harvard or Yale, places like that, now they have specialized teams to recruit homeschoolers because they are the very best students you see. There's a focus. And now if you put homeschool on your college application, that's a plus, not a minus. So we're seeing this vibrant experimentation, interesting things happening on the homeschool front. I think the single best education policy in the state of Texas is the fact that if you start a private school, you can do whatever you want. If you are in a homeschool, you can do whatever you want. They'll regulate it. Oh, but what about the nuts? The nuts are going to be nutty, and they're going to have nutty kids no matter what you do. They'll have nutty kids when they see the public school. But what you have in most of the homeschool people I've met, you have some very interesting, committed parents, I mean, really working hard with their kids. So I think this is where a lot of the innovation is going to drive. If there's one single thing we want to protect in the state of Texas, it's the freedom to do this. The other interesting things that are coming are this self-paced gaming software for the specialized skills. In the elementary school, we're using these game-based software for reading, writing, math, foreign languages. No question in my mind now, we've finally got to the place where Dreambox and Learning Today are the best of these programs. We no longer need a teacher to teach those subjects. You need a mentor. You need a coach. You need somebody to take the kid by the hand and help them and take the student. But to actually teach the basics, these programs will adjust your learning style. They'll allow you to go at your own pace. They will measure your performance. They will back up and make sure you've remembered what you did before. And most of all, they are really, really fun. I mean, they use all the cutting-edge game tricks. We create a lot of simulations at the Big Acton. They are really cool, and we have to pull the kids off of them. We have to limit the amount of time they can spend learning math. And I'm convinced this is one big key to why our students advance 2.5 grade levels in 10 months. The build of these programs. Also, though, this treating the student on a hero's journey, the ability to have Socratic discussions with students, and the ability to involve them in real-world projects, you'd be amazed at how much they care about math when they have to use it to solve a real-world problem, and then talk about their own hero's journey in a group. I'm not kidding when I say the elementary age kids at Acton Academy are better at business and know more about how to run a business than the incoming MBAs we get. They truly, the discussions they have are on a more profound level about business, life, and customer, and listening than what we hear at the MBA level. It is amazing how smart the average elementary school child is. It is not amazing to me that most of them hate to be in public schools. I'm worried about the ones that like to be in public schools. I'm not, in fact, I would encourage my child to drop out. I'd rather have him go get a job than be stuck in a bad public school. So I think I'm really worried about folks saying, let's keep them all in the schools. They're bored to tears. They hate it. They should hate it. All right, higher education, here's what's coming. Higher education 2010, kind of expensive, seems to be doing okay, but there's a tsunami forming. By higher education 2015, this isn't long from now, you're going to start to see the effect of the internet private label companies. Let me be clear what this is. You've got the University of Phoenix, and they're offering a very mediocre education at a fairly high price. What's happening, though, is there are a number of private equity firms funding groups that will now come in to University of Texas, Michigan, Purdue, University of Southern California. Those are real examples. And they're saying, hey, Chip, you teach a course. We'd like to put it on the internet and you can be famous. And Chip goes, great. Now, I'll tell you, because I've watched what they do, they actually take Chip's pretty sorry course he's been lecturing for 20 years and they turn it into something that's still mediocre, but it's better than Chip's course. Then they create and recruit a whole bunch of coaches and tutors that work for $10 an hour. And they sell a product that delivers a better education than Chip's on-campus program for about 10 cents on the dollar, and it has a USC label on it, or a Michigan label. I've got a friend that's running one of these companies who he has 125,000 students now. They'll have 175,000 by the end of the year. He told me a fascinating story. He was at the University of Florida. President came to him recently. He said, you know who the biggest system is in Florida? President of the Florida system. So we are. He goes, no. Actually, y'all are four. It's Phoenix, DeVry, Kaplan, in Florida, not nationally. Guy turned kind of pale. My friend said, and by the way, we're going to be offering a Michigan, Purdue, USC, name three or four other schools, in Tallahassee the next year at 10 cents on the dollar of what you guys offer. Guy turned pale. He said, now your decision is, you want to get on the train or are you going to be under the train? Florida committed that day. So here's what's going on. These guys are so desperate for incremental revenue because the tenured salaries keep growing and they've tapped out tuition. They'll do anything for incremental revenue. I went to my friend after he told the story and said, you realize your business isn't going to work. Oh, yeah, 1 minute. All right. Your business isn't going to work. You're going to start a price war. It's going to diminish the value of all the credentials. My friend's actually already very wealthy. You know what he said? Terrific, because I want to put them all out of business. So what's coming in is a new way, and we can talk about this in the Q&A, but there's a new way, and I'll circle back in the Q&A, talk about Google plus Alcoholics Anonymous plus the Boy Scouts, that I think is the model that's going to do the last thing, which is these just distributed apprenticeships and portfolios. They're going to finally squeeze the life out of higher education. And so, and this is an example that I'll talk about that we're doing at Acton. This is another example of the portfolios. Because what's going to happen in the end, we are going to be the future of education, not just us, but all the entrepreneurs out there. And it is coming faster than you think. Thank you.
I do not have a slide presentation. As some of you know or may have heard, Kauffman Foundation has been working with the U.S. military on something we call expeditionary economics. And for anyone who knows the military or has been in the military, you'll appreciate that as a result, we now have a wonderful aversion to using PowerPoint slides in a lot of our appearances. That's not a knock on Jeff, because I know Jeff shares that aversion. I want to thank the roundtable for inviting, and Adam for inviting the foundation to participate. Two of my Kauffman colleagues are here, so I will freely refer tough questions to them in the Q&A session. So, just so they know and you know. I was asked to talk about, sort of, to give an overview of some of our programming, our entrepreneurship education programming, both that we've done and learned from, and some of the newer programs that we are trying to put in place on the basis of the lessons that we've learned, both successes and failures. And I just wanted to start with sort of the predicate of a lot of these programs, sort of how we approach them, or what are sort of some of our underlying ideas and assumptions. We try, as many of you do, as I know Jeff does, we try very hard to have a very close relationship between our research, both the research that we do in-house and the research that we fund, and also the programs that we run and that we fund. And that's, as you know, that's a two-way relationship. We want to inform our programs with our research and then sort of design our research around our programs. With the Kauffman Labs program, it's very much a laboratory for starting entrepreneurs, but it's also a laboratory for us on the research side to sort of watch entrepreneurship, to study entrepreneurship in real time. We start from, I think, a presumption that most of you share, and again, I know Jeff shares, and that's just the overriding importance of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship to economic growth. Joe mentioned, you know, most net job creation in the U.S. is driven by new and young companies. I don't think I have to emphasize that with you, but that's where we start from. It's still a phenomenon, I think, that we don't completely understand, we meaning the U.S. in general. I don't just mean Kauffman, and so we still do a lot of research to try to really dig into it. What happens at the moment of creation? What happens when you're growing a company? We've benefited a lot from partners like Acton because that's what they're doing. But along the way in our research and some of our programs, we've come up against what you might call puzzles or maybe some surprises, I guess. And one of those that has really informed some of our more recent programs is that if you look over the past 30 or 40, even about the last 60 years, the rate of entrepreneurship in the U.S. it's pretty constant. It doesn't change much. Now, this sort of runs against what we had assumed, and I think what's popularly held as the conventional narrative, you know, the U.S. moved from high entrepreneurial capitalism in sort of the late 19th, early 20th century, to sort of a stultified, you know, GM-type capitalism in the mid-20th century, and then to a rebirth or a renewal of entrepreneurial capitalism in the 80s and 90s. And there's some true dimensions to that story, but it's sort of at the margins, because if you just look at the overall rate of entrepreneurship, it hasn't changed much, actually, going back to the 40s. And there's some evidence, although I'm not completely sure about using it, that it might have been pretty constant for the entire 20th century. Now, that's not a bad thing, because it means it wasn't falling, right? It means it wasn't increasing. But this is one of the things we've sort of struggled with, because if you look, you know, since about 1980, there's been a huge explosion of programs and attempts to boost and increase and promote entrepreneurship, whether that's venture capital and angel capital on the financing side, or on the programmatic side, entrepreneurship education courses and degrees at colleges and universities, and also things like incubators. There's been a huge increase in incubators. We actually have a paper coming out soon on whether or not incubators work. They don't, just a preview for the paper. On the campus side, and you probably know this, I think in 1980 there were about 200 institutions offering courses in entrepreneurship, and today it's well over 2,000. It might even be close to 2,500 or 3,000. There's just been a huge explosion of courses, of degrees, you know, even PhD programs in entrepreneurship. And we have funded a lot of those. We've worked in that cross-campus entrepreneurship space, but one of the things we're finding is that all these efforts perhaps haven't done a lot, if much at all, to increase entrepreneurship. Now, I know that that's not entirely the point of a VC fund or an angel investor. They're out, you know, to grow specific companies. The point of a venture capital fund is not to boost U.S. entrepreneurship by another million companies or whatever. But even with the campus programs and incubators, you haven't seen much effect. And it could be possible, right, that they've kept the rate of entrepreneurship in the U.S. from falling. So maybe it's the but-for test for those programs. That's probably a pretty impossible test to run, to go back and run. So this is what we sort of struggled with in saying, if all these attempts haven't done much to increase entrepreneurship, and if we know that we need, first of all, just more entrepreneurs in the U.S., but also more, whatever you want to call them, high-impact, growth-scale entrepreneurs. What can we do? And that's sort of one of the questions we started with, particularly after our experience with working with universities. And Kauffman Labs really finds its genesis, the Kauffman Laboratories for Enterprise Creation that Joe mentioned, really finds its genesis in our experience with higher ed. We worked with a number of campuses across the country on cross-campus entrepreneurship. So trying to move entrepreneurship out of the traditional business school where it doesn't happen, as Jeff knows and as you know, to the schools of engineering, the school of architecture, wherever. And we had, I think, some modest success with it. It was uneven, but overall, I think we found that it wasn't doing what we had sort of hoped, which is creating actual companies. You know, if you take a course at a university, you know, at the end of the semester, you have a business plan, or you're somehow anointed an entrepreneur, and that doesn't work. And Kauffman Lab, we've really tried to inform ourselves that you need a more intensive model. You need sort of almost an incubator model where you can really cultivate these companies. So when we go about, you know, putting into place Kauffman Labs or iBridge and iStart, some of the other programs that I can talk about, I think that were listed in the session description, we really have three basic ideas that we try to infuse those with. One of them is that it's all about networks. And I don't think that's surprising, but I don't mean networks in the sense that someone introduces me to Jeff and now I have access to a capital fund or whatever. Those are important. I think what we found is it's the connections, you know, connections between people, between organizations, between ideas. That's where innovation, that's where entrepreneurship happens. So that's what we're trying to do with a lot of our new programs, is build that platform to connect people who otherwise never would have been connected. They would have been isolated, their company either never would have happened or it would have sort of just died out or stayed small. The second idea is that, you know, there's this running debate, and Jeff sort of alluded to it, of the born, are entrepreneurs born or made? And it'll probably never ever be resolved, but I think we sort of come down to this and that it's both, right? It's a little bit of both. And so we really approach this from the position that there are huge amounts of what we might call latent entrepreneurship in the population, right? People who, they have ideas, but they don't see themselves as entrepreneurs. They never would have considered that as a career, right? It's just not put in front of them. Or they are starting a company and they have an idea, but they can't even get to the point where they have to worry about something like the valley of death or whatever. So, you know, part of the idea with labs, with Kauffman Labs and with iStart, it's to sort of call forth that latent entrepreneurship, and we're doing a lot of work in places like Detroit with organizations like Maker Faire and TechShop, whose the very idea of those programs is to bring people in to say, hey, this is a possibility for you, and you have a lot of ideas, you have a lot of potential. Come and sort of explore those, and maybe you'll start a company. And I think the signals are we're having positive success. Those are hugely successful programs in their own right. That's sort of the point of bringing those programs to places like Detroit. And the third idea we sort of try to work with is, as I mentioned, we want to focus on, or we want to try to get more high-impact, growth-scale entrepreneurs, however you want to define them or however you want to label them. That doesn't mean that, you know, we shouldn't try for just a higher volume of entrepreneurship, because in a very abstract sense, you know, the only way you get high-growth entrepreneurs in the first place is by having a lot of entrepreneurs to begin with. So those are sort of our three general ideas, and they may or they may not sound revolutionary, but it's helped us to really hone in on those after our experience with university entrepreneurship programs, with incubator programs, particularly with in our dealings with venture capitalists. And so, you know, there's a number of programs that we could highlight or that maybe you want to ask about, but I just want to focus on two, one of those being Kauffman Labs, which I've already talked about. We're now entering our second year, or sort of our second class, and what it does is we specifically try to identify and recruit potentially successful entrepreneurs. Some of the people may have already started their company. We don't want to get them too far along, but maybe that, you know, they already see themselves as an entrepreneur. But a lot of these people, they just have a great idea and it hasn't even occurred to them to start a company, or they just don't know how to do it. So our first class focused on postdoctoral fellows. And for those of you who are familiar with it, postdocs are sort of in this academic purgatory where they've gotten their PhD, they can't get a job, they're stuck in some star professor's lab. And there's 43,000 of these folks over the U.S. And not all of them are going to be innovative entrepreneurs, but a lot of them have terrific ideas. And so our first class of entrepreneurs at labs focused on postdocs in mostly, I think, in the biomedical space. And we're just now sort of at the tail end of their year, their 1 year. And I think John could better quote you the success statistics, but we've had a number of companies started. We had about 13, I think, in terms of we've had good success with investments, and also several have gotten SBIR funding. So it looks like, you know, at least initially, we may have had success with this group. It's obviously going to be harder going forward. We're now at sort of the end stage of recruiting our second class, and this is going to focus on education, which, you know, is obviously of particular interest to the roundtable and to many of you. I had a chance to participate in the recruiting process of this, but I think we're going to take maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen people. But we had several thousand applications for this, people from all over the country, people starting education companies. Some are nonprofit, some are for-profit, and it's really too bad we can't take like half of these folks, because as some of you already know, and maybe you're doing it, there are some amazing companies being started in the education space. It's just phenomenal at all levels of education, not just K-12, but also post-secondary training programs for workers who've already been out in the workforce. So that's where we're focusing with labs on the second class. And we're going to have different verticals going forward. Energy, I think, is going to be one of our next ones. The second program that I just wanted to highlight is a very new one, and that's iStart. And this, it's basically a platform for running business plan competitions. And that may strike you as somewhat boring or somewhat rote, but it has two dimensions to it. One is, if your school or your organization, and I think the first one we did was like San Diego State, if you are running a business plan competition, this iStart will sort of host it for you. It'll be the platform, right? So it takes a lot of your headache away. But the second dimension of it is, I think, far more interesting and far more important, and I think we see it that way too. And that's it's going to serve as sort of a national repository of business ideas, because all these business plans are going to be loaded into the iStart database. Now, you can choose not to make it public, but you know, if you're participating in a business plan competition, obviously it's going to be out there. But what we've already seen and what we hope for is that this is going to connect people from all across the country to ideas that they never, ever would have come into contact with before. And I think we already have sort of a couple of those stories, whether it's investors, whether it's other potential entrepreneurs who, oh yeah, I had an idea like that too, maybe we could work together. And these people, this is sort of goes back to the idea of building, you know, the connections between people. But that's the way you get more entrepreneurs and more successful entrepreneurs. So I think iStart is very new. We've only just started. It's going to have an international component to it. But I think it has huge potential. You know, just sort of that simple idea of a platform. But it has huge potential to sort of build those networks that never would have existed, and therefore to bring in companies that never would have existed in the first place and to make them successful. So those are just two of the ideas, and some of you may want to ask about specific programs, but we can talk more about that in the Q&A.
Thank you very much.